From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview from the archives with the author Susan Cain, whose book is Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, which was published by Broadway Books. Susan Cain is the co-founder of Quiet Revolution, LLC. Her New York Times bestseller, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, has been translated into 36 languages, has appeared on many best of lists, and was named the number one best book of the year by Fast Company magazine, which also named Cain one of its most creative people in business. Her book was the subject of a Time magazine cover story, and her writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. Her record-smashing TED Talk has been viewed over 10 million times and was named by Bill Gates one of his all-time favorite talks. She lives in the Hudson River Valley with her husband and two sons. Here's a little information about her book, Quiet. At least one-third of the people we know are introverts. They are the ones who prefer listening to speaking, who innovate and create but dislike self-promotion, who favor working on their own over working in teams. It is to introverts Rosa Parks, Chopin, Dr. Seuss, Steve Wozniak that we owe many of the great contributions to society. In Quiet, Susan Cain argues that we dramatically undervalue introverts and shows how much we lose in doing so. She charts the rise of the extrovert ideal throughout the 20th century and explores how deeply it has come to permeate our culture. She also introduces us to successful introverts from a witty, high-octane public speaker who recharges in solitude after his talks, to a record-breaking salesman who quietly taps into the power of questions. Passionately argued, superbly researched, and filled with indelible stories of real people, Quiet has the power to permanently change how we see introverts and, equally important, how they see themselves. I spoke to Susan Cain in the spring of 2012, and when we had our conversation, I began by asking her if there had been a single moment when she decided to write this book, an aha moment, as people say, or if the idea percolated for a very long time before she decided to sit down and start on it. I hope that you enjoy our conversation.
I think that the idea has been percolating, honestly, since I was 4 years old. of course, when I was four, I didn't have a language for the ideas in this book or for the word introvert, but I've been aware of these issues since then. I think many children are, many introverted children. I think I was quite aware that I was the kind of kid who liked to read, who liked to play quietly with friends in one-on-one settings. And, you know, I was kind of mystified by all the group activities that we were obliged to participate in.
Yes.
I liked to go off by myself and do projects, creative projects. I was aware that these things were considered normal in my family, but that when I got outside my family, there was just a kind of mismatch that I think I've been struggling to understand my entire life. And the book was a way of working it out.
So it must have been kind of a relief to get to an age where you realized that this is something you could study, research, and meet other people that were in the same position. And I suppose as an adult, you knew that already. But there must be a point where kids start to realize that they're not alone.
Yeah, but you know what? You're actually right. It's true that as an adult, I did start to feel less alone in this and, you know, start to understand it better. But I didn't really understand it truly until I started writing and researching the book. Because I would say when I first started working on this book, I actually felt sometimes, honestly, I felt embarrassed sometimes to tell people what I was working on because introversion is so stigmatized in our society. And so, you know, I felt like if I introduced myself as, hi, I'm working on this book about introversion, it was like leading with something stigmatizing about my own self. But then over time, as I started to really understand it better and to understand how widespread it is, you know, how many people feel the exact same way that I do and how normal it truly is, you know, a lot of those feelings really started to just melt away.
Right, yeah.
So it's been incredibly empowering that way.
And for other people, too, I imagine you get a lot of feedback from people that it's been very helpful to them.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, that has been the single most, you know, exciting and gratifying aspect of having written this book. I mean, letters flooding in from people, you know, talking about how it's changed their psyches and changed their approach to life. You know, I think there really is a sense of liberation of being able to talk about things that have felt, you know, that you feel like you couldn't admit.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I really loved about the book, and I'll just let me just put the title out there again, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and it's published by Crown. I love the fact that so much of the book is your research, your conversations with people, you're setting a baseline of understanding for your reader. And then there are moments where you make suggestions about how people who are introverts or perhaps are parents of introverts, you know, might consider moving forward in order to help themselves and their children and their friends and their social lives. But it's not a self-help book. I wouldn't put it in that genre, but it is very helpful and also very scientifically based.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. That was actually, that was a balance I kind of labored mightily to achieve, because I really wanted the book to be of practical help, but I didn't want kind of like a bullet point thing. I wanted it to be sort of more deeply grounded.
Yeah.
So that's something I was trying to do. And yeah, and you know, one of the chapters that I am most excited about is, it's actually the final chapter, and it's the one about children and what to do if you have an introverted child, and you know, how to cultivate that child, how to let them be who they are, but also give them the tools they need to survive in a more extroverted society, but grow into their own wonderfully introverted self.
Yeah, and one thing that was really interesting when I got to that chapter, I had already read your research about, you know, the statistics of, you know, how many introverts had introverted parents or not, and is this a genetic phenomenon? Are we inheriting our extroversion or introversion? And so that was really interesting. Then you get to the chapter where you realize that, of course, a lot of these parents don't necessarily know what it's like to be an introvert, and so it's hard for them to figure out how to raise this quiet child.
Yeah, that's quite a phenomenon, actually. In fact, I would say the most common family configuration that I run into all the time is introverted. You have two parents. One is an introvert, one's an extrovert. And then let's say you have two children, and again, one's an introvert and one's an extrovert. Now, obviously, there are many variations within this, but I do see these mixed families all the time.
Yeah.
And as you say, you know, it can be really challenging for an extroverted parent to have a child with such a different temperament. And there really needs to be a kind of leap of understanding.
Yes.
That can go a long way. And one of the moms who I talk about in the book is a really, you know, kind of hyper extroverted, really dynamic sort of go-getter of a person.
Yeah.
And she has an introverted daughter, and she talks about how at first she would have these experiences, like she would go to pick up her daughter at school at the end of the day and find all the kids playing together in the yard and her daughter off by herself shooting baskets. And she said it was too painful for her to watch. She had to stop going to pick up for a while. And she was also perplexed by it because she knew that her daughter was a very loving, empathetic girl who had a lot of friends. And so she couldn't understand why she wasn't with those friends. You know, why was she isolating herself in this way? But then she started over time to understand what it meant to be an introvert. And she said that it completely changed her way of parenting. You know, so instead of forcing her daughter out to play date after play date, she would sit down and strategize with her. You know, how many play dates work for you? And when do you need to just go home and just talk to your mom or be alone in your room? And, you know, it was like a whole new world opened up once they could understand it through that lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, too, it must be helpful to parents who are raising extroverts, and perhaps they are encouraging their children to, like, invite that quiet little girl over. You know, she definitely could use some more friends or something like that. And I would think that, now my children are too old, I don't have to worry about how how they interact with little ones anymore because they're making those decisions for themselves. But, you know, I would just think that, looking back, I probably would have let my children just choose their own friends and do their own thing a little bit more than I did. You know, I was always sort of encouraging friendships that maybe, you know, maybe they weren't meant to be. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, this is such a tricky thing because, I, you know, none of this is to say that parents can't and shouldn't do a lot of encouraging also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, especially if you have a child who is either more fearful or just sort of more overwhelmed in social situations. But if as a parent you sense that your child would actually be happy in those social situations once they punch through those inhibitions, then there are steps that you can and should take, you know, to help your child get there.
Right.
But the question is, how do you help them on their own terms? So, you know, instead of pushing them forward, like to act as quickly as a more extroverted child would, you know, you take the time that they need and you go with them step by slow step.
Yes.
To get to the fun on the other side.
Yeah. Early in the book, Susan, you include a test that people can take to decide where they fall on the introvert-extrovert spectrum. And so I took the test, and it was so interesting. I'm sure everybody thinks, you know, they're all so interesting. but as I took the test, I found myself, I've always been an extrovert. I know I'm an extrovert, but I found that the answers that I was, you know, considering, I was doing two things. I was thinking, how would I have answered this question 20 years ago, and how do I answer this question now? And I realized I really have changed. I used to be much more of an extrovert than I necessarily am now. Is that consistent? Do people tend to change in this regard as they age?
Yeah. It's really interesting. Psychologists call this intrinsic maturation. And basically, there are a whole bunch of personality traits where people sort of shift over time. And when it comes to this one, introversion, extroversion, most people do get more introverted with age.
Mm.
Although the interesting thing is you still kind of maintain your ranking, so to speak. So let's say if you think back to where you were in high school compared to your peers, you know, how extroverted were you compared to your peers? And if you now went to your high school reunion, you would probably be more or less the same rank. So if you were the 10th most extroverted person in your class, you'd probably be that still today, but all of you would have shifted over time to become more introverted.
Interesting. Oh, that's really... Now, what role does environment play? Like, for example, my husband's an introvert, you know, or the people you spend most of your time with, if your siblings are introverted or extroverted, or if your parents were, or, you know, I'm environment, not genetics. So will that play a role in how you change?
And how you change over time.
Over time.
Yeah, you know, sure, all these things play a role. Yeah. You know, a lot of it has to do also with what kind of job you have. You know, if you have the kind of job that requires you to be sort of out there all the time.
Right.
That can kind of push you a little bit. Well, it can kind of push you in two different directions. You know, it might make you more extroverted, or it might make you react the other way, you know, where you kind of burn out on it. But in any event, I kind of tend to think those changes tend to be the more superficial ones. I think people are more or less who they are deep down, and what they're changing is more their day-to-day adaptations to their roles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even in those cases, if you gave them truly the freedom to act exactly as they wished, they would revert back to the way they truly want to be acting.
Okay. In the book, you point out that introverts and extroverts tend to be, you know, equally intelligent based on IQ scores.
Yeah.
So you know, the generalization that the bookish intellectual introvert is smarter, that might not be a true generalization. But what are a few generalizations about introverts and extroverts that are true?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the one that you mentioned is it is true that introverts tend to be sort of bookish and intellectual. I mean, not all of them, but
okay, more so.
But what's fascinating about this is that it's not a function of IQ, as you say, that makes them that way. It has nothing to do with intelligence. What it has to do with is it's kind of a preference of how you spend your time. So introverts tend to be more careful. They tend to kind of sit still more. They tend to really focus. If you give them a difficult task to perform, like let's say a hard math problem or that kind of thing, introverts will spend much more time than extroverts will inspecting the problem and analyzing it even before they jump in. And then they'll spend more time working at it and more often get the right answer than extroverts will. And again, that's not about intelligence. It's about a different behavioral style. So it's like the very behavioral style that sometimes gives introverts a bad rap. You know, they're not talking enough, they're sort of slow to make decisions, that kind of thing. that same behavioral style is a real asset intellectually.
Right.
And in fact, we know that introverts get better grades. They win more academic scholarships. They score higher on certain kinds of problem-solving tests, all this kind of thing. And it's all about behavior.
In the book you mentioned that introverts can maintain focus longer. I think you were talking about selling, cold call selling on the phone. And there was this great moment where somebody you interviewed said, well, the extroverts might be doing really well until some bright, shiny thing crosses their path, and then they get off base and they lose their focus. So I assume that's probably the same thing for studying and staying in touch with in school and stuff.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And you know, nowadays, so much of our educational system is focused on having kids work together in groups and teaching each other. And I have a lot of issues with that for all kinds of reasons. But one of my issues is I think this is doing extroverted children a disservice, because these kids, to begin with, it's not as easy for them to kind of sit still and focus and persist in these kinds of ways. And yet being able to sit down and work by yourself is such a crucial skill.
Right.
So we need to be teaching, you know, introverted kids will more or less figure out that skill, whether it's presented to them or not, because it's their nature. Extroverted kids won't do it unless you teach them how. So I think it's really important that we teach them.
Yeah.
We know, like, there's this amazing psychologist, Anders Ericsson, who did groundbreaking work on how we acquire expertise. Like, how do people get to be really amazing at what they do? And so he studied expert performers in all different realms, from tennis players to chess players to mathematicians and musicians. And he found that all these people engaged in this thing that he calls deliberate practice, where you sit down by yourself and you practice in a really intense, focused way on your craft. You practice your craft. And you do it in this way where you're always working on the point that is a little bit challenging to you. Like, not too challenging, but just challenging enough. And it's the people who do that well and who know how to do it who succeed. And very often, he says, this work needs to be done alone. So, you know, kids who are not, or adults who don't have the wherewithal to be able to sit still by themselves and do this, really, they might be very talented and not be able to nurture that talent. So that's why it's so important that we be teaching it.
That's such a good piece of advice for writers, because we have to be able to sit alone and work.
Yes, yeah, this is true. And, you know, it's so funny that you say this. I was just talking last night with a woman who's a writer and an extrovert, and she was saying this is one of the hardest things for her as a writer. You know, it's one of the places introverts have an advantage, because it's kind of easy for an introvert to sit by themselves with their laptop, right?
And yeah,
like, for me, that's one of my favorite parts of my day, when I get to be alone with my laptop. I love that. But for many extroverts, they have a kind of approach avoidance conflict, where they're drawn to write and they're drawn to express, and they might be very beautiful writers, but the act of sitting down by themselves to make all of that happen is difficult and like something that they have to surmount every day.
Yeah,
you know, and it's kind of like the mirror image of the kinds of things that introverts often have to surmount every day. You know, where introverts have to sort of push themselves forward to be more social than they might like.
Yeah, I found it really interesting. In the book, you mentioned that you like working in a cafe, and I thought to myself, because I used to try that, and it was just like the buzz and activity around me in a cafe was so distracting, I couldn't do it. So I need to be in a completely quiet, sealed off space. But it's interesting because, and maybe I'm overdoing this generalization thing, but maybe as an introvert, you can kind of focus and tune it all out a little more or something.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I have definitely noticed that phenomenon too. And my husband is an extrovert and a writer, and he used to come to the cafe where I wrote my whole book, and he would be like, how do you even, he said, I couldn't even write a postcard here. it was just so distracting for him.
That's so
and
funny.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think extroverts, when they're in that kind of a situation, often feel like an impulse to be engaged with it all.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can't be there and also focus. And for an introvert, you don't feel, as you say, this is general stuff, right? Because everyone feels differently. But I do think for many introverts, you're in that kind of setting, you don't feel the impulse to be engaged with it at all. I think what you feel is sort of the pleasure of being around other people, and it's actually nice to not have to talk to them. I think many introverts feel this way. Like they would be happy to go to a party if they didn't have to be chatting the whole time. Like if they could just be watching.
Yeah.
They would enjoy it a lot more. But it's not socially acceptable to go to a party and just watch. but at a cafe, you can do that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Susan, I'm wondering if maybe this is a good time for you to read a couple pages from the book.
Sure, I would love to. I think what I'll do is I will read a little section from the introduction.
Great.
To give listeners a sense of what the book is all about.
Okay, and I'll just say that this is Susan Cain reading from Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, published by Crown.
Our lives are shaped as profoundly by personality as by gender or race. And the single most important aspect of personality, the north and south of temperament, as the scientist J.D. Higley puts it, is where we fall on the introvert-extrovert spectrum. Our place on this continuum influences our choice of friends and mates and how we make conversation, resolve differences, and show love. It affects the careers we choose and whether or not we succeed at them. It governs how likely we are to exercise, commit adultery, function well without sleep, learn from our mistakes, place big bets in the stock market, delay gratification, be a good leader, and ask what if. And here I'm just inserting a note for listeners that the answers to all these questions can be found in the book. Okay, it's reflected in our brain pathways, neurotransmitters, and remote corners of our nervous systems. Today, introversion and extroversion are two of the most exhaustively researched subjects in personality psychology, arousing the curiosity of hundreds of scientists. These researchers have made exciting discoveries aided by the latest technology, but they're part of a long and storied tradition. Poets and philosophers have been thinking about introverts and extroverts since the dawn of recorded time. Both personality types appear in the Bible and in the writings of Greek and Roman physicians. And some evolutionary psychologists say that the history of these types reaches back even farther than that. The animal kingdom also boasts introverts and extroverts, from fruit flies to pumpkin seed fish to rhesus monkeys. And as with other complementary pairings, like masculinity and femininity, East and West, liberal and conservative, humanity would be unrecognizable and vastly diminished without both personality styles. And yet we make room for a remarkably narrow range of personality types. We're told that to be great is to be bold, to be happy is to be sociable. We live with a value system that I call the extrovert ideal, the omnipresent belief that the ideal self is gregarious, alpha, and comfortable in the spotlight. The archetypal extrovert prefers action to contemplation, risk-taking to heed-taking, certainty to doubt. He or she favors quick decisions, even at the risk of being wrong, works well in teams, and socializes in groups. We like to think that we value individuality, but all too often we admire one type of individual, the kind who is comfortable putting himself out there. Sure, we allow technologically gifted loners who launch companies in garages to have any personality they please, but they are the exceptions, not the rule, and our tolerance extends mainly to those who get fabulously wealthy or hold the promise of doing so. But we make a grave mistake to embrace the extrovert ideal so unthinkingly. Some of our greatest ideas, art, and inventions, from the theory of evolution to Van Gogh's sunflowers to the personal computer, came from quiet and cerebral people who knew how to tune into their inner worlds and the treasures to be found there. Without introverts, the world would be devoid of Newton's theory of gravity, Einstein's theory of relativity, Yeats's The Second Coming, Chopin's Nocturnes, Proust's In Search of Lost Time, Peter Pan, Orwell's 1984, The Cat in the Hat, Charlie Brown, the films of Steven Spielberg, Google, co-founded by introvert Larry Page, and Harry Potter. As the science journalist Winifred Gallagher writes, the glory of the disposition that stops to consider stimuli rather than rushing to engage with them is its long association with intellectual and artistic achievement. Neither EMC squared nor Paradise Lost was dashed off by a party animal. And here you go.
Thank you very much for reading that. I love that last sentence there.
It's a great quote.
It is such a great one. This is a quote from the book, Dale Carnegie's metamorphosis from farm boy to salesman to public speaking icon is also the story of the rise of the extrovert ideal. And you did talk a little bit about the extrovert ideal right now. And I'm just wondering if we can talk just a little bit more about that, about the extrovert ideal and why it is so prevalent, especially in this country. It sounds like there are other countries where it does not have quite the impact that it has here. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, the extrovert ideal is basically a value system that we all live with that says that the ideal self is very bold, very gregarious, very comfortable in the spotlight. And for us in Western cultures, this is partly part of our cultural DNA. You know, we're founded on Greco-Roman ideals, and those ideals have always celebrated great oratory. But still, up until the turn of the 20th century, this was still a country, the United States I'm now speaking of, was still a country that where it was okay to be an introvert, too, because we lived then in what historians call a culture of character, where people valued you based on your inner self, based on are you a good person or not. Mm-hmm. But then what happened is we started moving into the cities. People started taking jobs in corporate America, and instead of working alongside people they had known all their lives, now they had to stand out in a crowd of strangers. And so qualities like being very magnetic and dynamic and personable became all important. And this is when we moved into what historians call a culture of personality. And that is still the society we live in today. It was around this time, the turn of the 20th century, that Dale Carnegie wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People, his famous book. And if you look, that book today on Amazon is still number 200.
Oh, my gosh.
Like almost 100 years after it was written. It's still a top seller. So we still very much live in that sort of a culture. And as you suggest, it's not the same the world over, particularly in Far Eastern societies, in traditional Far Eastern cultures. There's much more of an emphasis on group harmony. And the way you cultivate group harmony is by having each individual be more quiet, more unassuming, more careful with words. And so in these cultures, people who are more reserved are seen as wise and judicious and strong because they have the strength to have restraint, whereas we see strength as being the strength to put yourself out there. It's almost like a mirror image ideal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although, you know, in thinking about all this, I'm also realizing that there's putting yourself out there in a way that's irritating to people too. And I think that quiet people are respected for their reserve here, but there's a certain kind of extrovert that is just, you know, gregarious and people are drawn to that person. There's also the person you really avoid at a party because they just never let you get a word in edgewise. And, you know, so
yeah,
I don't know. There's different types of both, I guess.
That is true. And, you know, I should say with all of this stuff, like almost every single thing I've said today, in a sense, there's more complexity than you can kind of convey while also conveying the main point. There are definitely variations with all of this.
Right.
And in fact, one of the things that I tried to do in the book is present portrait after portrait of people who are quiet and yet people are drawn to them and yet they're very powerful, you know, and
right.
they figure out ways to be powerful in their quiet. I think that the real challenge for many quiet people is figuring out, okay, you know, most of them are aware of some kind of a cultural bias against their way of being. So first, how do you process that bias? You know, how do you rise above it without letting it affect your psyche and your vision of yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And then just sort of more practically speaking, okay, how do I take my temperament and really make it powerful? You know, one of the things I showed in the book is so many creative people who have done that. And then also, in a way, most interesting and surprising to me was how many quiet leaders there are. You know,
yes.
I think we don't think of leaders as being this way. We think of leadership as being almost necessarily an exercise in being very dynamic, very sort of classically inspiring, you know?
Right.
And yet so many of our transformative leaders, many have been extroverts, but many have been introverts too. People like Gandhi, people like Rosa Parks, people like Eleanor Roosevelt. These were all people who hated the spotlight, like hated it. And yet they took the spotlight because they were drawn by the cause that they cared about. And it turns out that has a strangely paradoxical power because like these people's followers could sense that they were doing what they did not out of a love out of the spotlight, but out of a desire to affect change. And people can feel that kind of authenticity.
Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting in the book when you talked about some of these quiet leaders who were so effective at leading extroverts, actually, in a lot of cases. But I also was thinking about that when I was reading this. I was thinking, sadly, in our voting system, I suspect we don't vote in America for the introverts anymore, because it seems like so much of who we vote for has to do with coming across well on television and speaking up and speaking confidently. And do you agree with that, or am
I? Well, you know, it's funny. No, I mean, yes, no, I do agree with that in general. But I would also say that right now we might have the first presidential race in history between two introverts. I think Obama is probably an introvert, and I think Romney probably is as well.
That's interesting. Okay.
You know, and there are a lot of introverts with really strong social skills, and I think that both of these men would be in that category.
Oh, that's really interesting. So, and you did talk about in the book, you know, sort of how introverts can become more comfortable and confident in public speaking situations and in situations where they have to sort of present themselves as extroverts, even if it's just briefly because it's for a cause they're passionate about. But that must be really hard. They're doing it all the time on the campaign trail.
I know, but you know, public speaking is a funny thing. Well, first of all, a lot of people who are uncomfortable with public speaking are shy, and I don't think that either Obama or Romney is shy. I just think they're introverted, you know, in the sense of preferring environments that are a little quieter and more thoughtful, as opposed to sort of being out in the hurly-burly.
Yeah.
And so there is a subset of introverts who are quite comfortable with public speaking. I think both of them are probably in that category. But, you know, if you look at President Obama, he delivers really fantastic speeches when he knows he needs to. I think he's kind of a classic introvert in that he rises to the occasion when he needs to do it. But I don't think it's his cup of tea. And I think that that's why he is often faulted for he's sometimes criticized for seeming lackluster or for not socializing enough in Washington. And I think probably a lot of that is him being sort of a natural introvert, but then he sort of pulls it out when he needs to.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
You know, and as opposed to, let's say, a more classic politician like a Bill Clinton, where you just feel like he couldn't really live and he couldn't have energy if he weren't out and around crowds all the time. I think Obama is probably the exact opposite. You know, to live and to be energetic, he needs to retreat.
Okay. You tell the story in the book of the bus to Abilene, which is an interesting concept in the United States Army. If a group of people end up on a bus to Abilene, and then when they get there, they can never decide whose idea was this anyway. I never really wanted to come here. Is that sort of the gist of it?
Yeah. Well, it's the idea that that you might all be sitting around on a porch on a lazy Sunday, and one person says, "Hey, let's take a bus to Abilene." And just because somebody has initiated action, everybody will just kind of follow lockstep, and suddenly you have the whole group on a bus to Abilene. And in fact, no one ever really wanted to go.
Okay.
But they followed the action person. And this is apparently like a real trope in the U.S. Army. Whenever they are worried that they're just sort of all acting in a group, they'll say, "Are we getting on a bus to Abilene here, or do we really want to be going in this direction?"
Right. I loved that. And you wrote in the book, "This reveals our tendency to follow those who initiate action, any action." But here's another thing that you said in the book. "If we assume that quiet and loud people have roughly the same number of good and bad ideas, then we should worry if the louder and more forceful people always carry the day. This would mean that an awful lot of bad ideas prevail while good ones get squashed." So I'm assuming that that's sort of relevant to the bus to Abilene, where it's just sort of like the louder people are convincing a group to go in a certain direction that maybe not the best direction.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, I think that this is one of the great problems that afflicts our culture, because we do live in a society, you know, psychologists have shown this again and again, where we all have a tendency to follow the opinions of the most assertive or most charismatic person in the room. And yet, there is, as you were just suggesting, there is zero correlation between being the best talker and having the best ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a huge problem, because so the most charismatic person in the room might at any given point have the best idea, but they might not. And so how crazy is it for us as a society to tend to follow always that person's opinions? We'd be so much better off if we could figure out a way around this bias that we all tend to have. So I think this is one of the great challenges, especially for workplaces or for any kind of organization that needs to be making important decisions. How can you get the best of everybody's brains? And how can you decide who has the best ideas without being held sway to, mm-hmm. to personal charisma?
Right.
And one way that people are starting to do this is by using online channels. There's one really interesting company called Right Solutions, where they've developed an online stock market where anybody can online advance an idea that they think the company should research. And if other people think it's a good idea, they can invest their nominal stock market cash, they can sign up to work on that project. And they did this explicitly because they wanted to harness the quiet geniuses in the company who they knew were not the ones who were going to come forward in a meeting with their ideas. And it's been incredibly successful. They've had a number of really profitable initiatives that have come out of this process. We're probably only scratching the surface on what we can do.
I would think that another complication to this is that the charismatic people in a group are used to always being listened to and recognized. And so they maybe even have a little bit less hesitance to, they think less about their ideas before throwing them out there, just because they're so used to everybody agreeing that they are, the ones with the good ideas.
That is such a good point. It's a really good point. And I think also, to the extent that they're extroverts, they're also less likely to think before advancing their ideas, only because for extroverts, the thinking process is to think out loud. For introverts, the thinking process is that you think first and then you speak. Now, there's a real downside to that, because what it means is introverts say this all the time. They go into meetings. They don't think of the thing that they wanted to say until 5 minutes after everybody has stopped talking about it already. Like, the discussion's moved on, and that's when they have their idea. And by then, it's too late. So extroverts are much better off in that they can, kind of think on the fly. But it does mean that the ideas that aren't yet fully prepared are the ones that get advanced to the group.
So we really
need each other. That's my fundamental conclusion. Introverts and extroverts need each other desperately because we each have strengths that the other one is just completely lacking. And we need to kind of put them together, and then we'll all be best off.
One question I had when I was reading this, I was looking at the title of the book, okay, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And you know what? It seemed to me like that was a title that was invented by an extrovert. Does that sound crazy?
Oh, that's so funny. I actually wanted to call the book Shake the World Gently, because there's this great Gandhi quote that I have in the book where he says, in a gentle way, you can shake the world. And, to me, that's the premise of everything I'm saying. But it was felt that, and I'm sure my advisors were right. They felt that was too poetic a title and nobody would know what on earth the book was about. So we did not go with that title.
How are you finding the whole process of marketing your book and doing the publicity, being on a book tour, talking to people like me? Is that something that you're comfortable with?
It's funny. It's something that I'm comfortable with because I care so much about what I'm saying in the book, and about advancing these ideas, that helps me transcend my normal discomfort to being in the spotlight. It is incredibly exhausting for me, for sure. And I have to take all kinds of breaks, and I have to pace myself. I think that's probably true for any writer on book tour. I think it's an exhausting experience. And I think probably most writers are introverts, but they just don't talk about their exhaustion.
I was really struck. There's a point in the book where you interview a director of human resources at a big media company, and that person said creative people, and what he or she meant was outgoing, fun, and jazzed up people. And I was like, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of creative people are not outgoing. And I know.
And yet there really is a misperception, I think, that, I think we think of creative people as being, you know, they're sort of like bouncing around, very colorful, and definitely a lot of creative people are that way. But then there are the ones who are more sort of off by themselves and being very contemplative and turning things over in their minds, you know, very different styles.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I kind of cut you off. You were talking about the book tour.
No, you know, just to say, yes, it's a very apt question. And before the book tour started, I was kind of dreading it, frankly. Like, I just didn't know how I was going to handle it. Now that it's here, I do find that I'm so excited to be getting this message out that, you know, on balance, it's a great thing. But it's also, yeah, it's a challenge for sure.
Yeah.
My publisher's been amazing about it. You know, because I wrote a whole book about introversion, they know all this. So so my publicist is always really solicitous, like, okay, we have you, you know, set for 2 radio interviews, and then I give you a break after that. You know, so she's really quite lovely.
Okay.
And that helps.
You have a chapter in the book on collaboration, which I found very interesting, and particularly I found it very interesting having been in a lot of writing groups and writing workshops, and I just wonder if we can talk about that from that perspective. Just collaboration as a, is it a positive or a negative thing, and for writers who might be in writing groups or writing workshops, what that might mean for them.
I think collaboration can be a wonderful thing. I mean, my critique of collaboration in the book is that we are now... That our culture has gone so crazy for all things collaboration that we now throw people together into groups, you know, just too much of the time, and we don't spend enough time valuing solitude. I think that a writer's group that's working well can be an incredible thing. And what it really means is, you know, you're spending all week going off by yourself and doing your writing, and then you come together with a group of trusted people with whom you share that work. And in fact, I will say this book wouldn't exist probably had I not been a member of a writer's group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I actually, when I stopped practicing law, I took a class in creative nonfiction at NYU, and it turned out to be this amazing class of people where we all really clicked. And so even when the semester was over, we all stayed together in a writer's group for years. It probably lasted about 4 years, and we shared each other's work. And I remember when I came up with the idea for this book, I told one of the members of that group about the idea, and she loved it, and she said, as soon as you're ready, I know a literary agent who will love this idea. And I always had that in the back of my mind, and a year later I had written a proposal and sent it to that agent, and his name is Richard Pine, and he became my agent.
Oh, wonderful.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in fact, that same woman who connected me with my agent is now publishing her first novel in the next year. And so we've been helping. And gosh, we enrolled in this class back in 2001. And so the writers group itself is no longer in existence.
Yeah.
But we're all still in touch and cheering each other on. And I think it's been an amazing thing.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You studied creative nonfiction. So did you ever start writing memoir or creative nonfiction work?
Yeah, in fact, I started off writing memoir. The first thing I did was I wrote a memoir both in prose and also in verse, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know, somehow I just decided not to publish it. I guess partly it felt too personal, but partly I just wasn't ready. And so that's actually sitting in my hard drive, and maybe one day I'll resurrect it. And then I wrote plays. I wrote all kinds of stuff for a few years, and then started working on this book.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about people being reward-oriented and threat-oriented?
Yeah. This is a fascinating thing. Psychologists have found out that some people have in their brains more active reward networks. These are the networks that involve heavily the neurotransmitter dopamine. And these are the networks that get us excited when we contemplate the prospect of a reward, like getting a promotion at work or chatting with somebody who you think is really handsome. That's all reward stuff. And extroverts tend to be have more active reward networks than introverts do.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean introverts don't have them. They do, but they're just not quite as jazzed up as extroverts are. So reward networks are quite a lovely thing, and they tend to be accompanied by really strong, happy emotions, which I think is part of what makes extroverts such lovely company.
You know,
I think they're often sort of in the throes of these happy emotions, like, oh, let's go do this fun thing. Yeah, you know, and it's kind of like an infectious enthusiasm.
Yeah.
However, the downside of that kind of way of being is that you don't tend to see warning signals quite as clearly. You might not be seeing reality in a way quite as clearly because you're sort of orienting to the reward and
okay.
you're not seeing other stuff that's around it. Whereas introverts tend to have a kind of more careful, more circumspect style. Warren Buffett, perfect example. He's an introvert. He is well known for having not gotten caught up in the big finance crises, you know, that felled other investors.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when we think about introverts and extroverts, we don't tend to think in terms of these sort of risk-reward dichotomies, but they really are relevant. In fact, extroverts have been found to get into more car accidents than introverts, to commit adultery more often, to place larger financial bets, and it's all connected to this sort of higher risk, higher reward style of being.
Yeah, there's a quote in the book where you're talking about buzz, which is a little bit different, but it you know, buzz being the
really
excitement.
Different.
Yeah. And you wrote, buzz is JFK's Camelot, but it also is the Kennedy curse. And I thought, that says it, doesn't it? That sort of says it's like, it's very exciting to have the buzz and the excitement and the motivation that comes with it. But there, you know, there's danger to it too, as you say in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I keep saying that we really need each other so much. I mean, I think the world would be a lot less colorful and maybe not have quite the same momentum without the extroverts among us. But it would also be out of control if it were only extroverts.
Yeah.
You know, we need each other.
So by extension, I just wanted to just quickly ask, so are introverts more threat-oriented typically, or...?
Not necessarily. Some introverts are and some are not.
Oh, okay.
You know, they're sort of two different axes. So introverts, they're less likely to get that crazy excitement thing that extroverts
okay.
get.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't necessarily mean that they're then oriented to focusing on danger signals.
Okay.
To actively focusing on them, although a subset of introverts are like that.
All right. Okay. Well, Susan, I just have one last question for you. What advice might you have for writers who are introverts and writers who are extroverts?
That's a great question. I mean, for writers who are introverts, I guess I would say, number one, take delight in your introversion because it is a huge asset in your writing that you might not be aware of, but it's really a gift to be able to sit still and be quiet the way you can be. The challenge is more likely going to be making sure that you stay networked so, you know, that when you do have that proposal written, you have a friend who has the right agent for you, you know, and can
right.
help you in that way and that you're helping others too. So, you know, maybe to push yourself to join a writer's group or that kind of thing. Extroverts kind of have the mirror image set of challenges and benefits. You know, I think of Rick Warren, the pastor who wrote The Purpose-Driven Life,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the great-selling books of all time. He talks about how the 7 months that he spent writing that book were torture for him because it was so hard for him to sit down and be alone working. So I think for extroverts, you're going to need to to come up with systems that work for you where you can sit down for a period of time but know you're going to get your social juice at the end of it. And maybe that means you have a three-hour writing chunk, but you have lunch plans with a friend for right after so that you know you're going to get your social fix.
That's a great idea. Okay. Well, this is great. Susan Cain, the book is Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, published by Crown. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
So that was quite fun talking to her in 2012. And actually, Crown was the original publisher of the book in 2012. I believe that it's since has transferred over to Broadway Books subsequently. So that was an interview with Susan Cain, author of the book Quiet. You can learn more about her work on her website, quietrev.com, as in revolution, quietrev.com. Is one of your characters an introvert? Do you know? This week's Write the Book prompt is to go to the quietrev.com website and take the introversion quiz on behalf of a character. Perhaps it will help you understand the way your character should think, act, and grow on the page. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, please let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter, and that's actually where you can hear or see my requests for input on playlists if I'm doing music at the end of the show. And on Facebook for updates, Write the Book. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or news about book-related events for the Bookworm's calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, if you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell your friends, and mostly tune in. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3, I keep saying that, 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.